This is the DTV Digest, the podcast that brings you news and reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema. And now, here's your host, Mike Parkin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the DTV Digest, the podcast which brings you reviews of films which didn't make it to the cinema and instead went straight to DVD, Blu-ray, or streaming media. I'm your host, Mike Parkin, and joining me this week is Will Bentley.
Hello.
Yeah, there he is. So apparently, Steve is, I think he's gone to see The Beautiful South or members thereof.
Was it not Snow Patrol?
Oh, yes, Snow Patrol, yeah. I think The Beautiful South one is another gig he's got lined up. But yeah, Snow Patrol is what he was doing. And Rich just needed a break. He's on a Ross Geller break from doing this. So he'll be back in a couple of weeks. So in this episode, this is a sort of it's a low budget horror episode, this one. So we're kicking off with a film called Hole, which is set in a swanky hotel where some sort of weird outbreak takes place. Then we've got a film called Sacrilege, set, which is a sort of interesting low-budget folk horror movie. And then our short shot this week is a film called The Manor. And instead of having a DTV throwback this week, we've got an interview with the director of Sacrilege, David Creed. So without further ado, let's crack on. So I'm joined by longtime collaborator, Will Bentley. Hi, Will.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Pretty damn good. Okay, so we're here to talk about a new horror film called Hall. Okay, so this is how IMDb describes this. It says, when a debilitating sickness spreads across a long hotel hallway, a few scattered victims fight for survival and try to escape from the dark, narrow stretch of isolated carnage. Now, I have to admit, you know, I was trying to write my own sort of synopsis for this a little bit earlier, because I'm writing a sort of written review for the film. And the best I could come up with, it sounded like the first paragraph of a Daily Mail article, because all of their articles sound the same. So it'd have been like, when Val and Morgan got to the hotel, they thought it was the start of their perfect holiday. Little did they know, terror awaited them. You know, it was something like that. And I was like, no, that sounds way too Daily Mail. Can't do that. So IMDb got it right for once. Okay, so this is the first feature film by Francesco Giannini. It looks great. It's got a great cast. But for me, the script kind of goes nowhere. It doesn't start very well for me, because I have a real bugbear with in media res, as people regular listeners will know.
And you mentioned this before, I think.
Yeah. I may have mentioned it in passing once or twice, but this film, you know, the thing is with in media res now, as soon as I see it, I know there's nothing going to be happening, you know, action wise or whatever, for about 20 minutes. Because that's the only reason, you know, that's 99% of the time, that's why it's used. You know, producers have got cold feet and gone, people are going to get bored. Or, you know, we need to sort of let them know that's, yes, eventually something's going to happen in this film. So, you know, that's usually what I said. There's been a few examples where they've used it to sort of wrong-foot the audience, or to try and provide a contrast between then and now sort of thing. But yeah, the film opens with various characters already infected and sort of crawling around the corridors and stuff, and then it jumps back 4 hours earlier. Great. However, to its credit, the film doesn't jump back to 4 hours or the person we've just seen crawling around the floor. It jumps back to Val and Morgan and their daughter Kelly. This was quite interesting, Will, in the way that, you know, this film deals, you know, at least initially, with you know, the idea of sort of marital abuse.
Yeah.
There's, you know, you pick up quite early that not everything's right here, and you know that the atmosphere reeks of like passive aggressiveness.
I actually, you know, in all honesty, I think that was like, this is a really good film, and the premise is obviously like a contagion, you know, a disaster of some sort. Don't want to give too much away about it. Carnage, you know, lots of kind of people dying, basically, and, you know, not knowing what's going on in a very kind of claustrophobic sort of environment, and the way they're dying is pretty, you know, grisly as well. But the, you know, so it's that whole kind of, you know, disease horror thing. But this, the, I think that the domestic violence, you know, the kind of the abuse angle was the best handled bit of the script by miles. I think that exactly like you said, all that, you know, it sort of builds up, sort of gradually you're like, oh, hang on, that's, he's been a bit of a dick there, you know, what she sort of mean by that and stuff, you know, what's she saying, and then you realize what's going on, what's actually happening, and it's like, and it's brilliantly done, and it's really quite disturbing.
It is, you know, because there is this sort of, you know, very controlled atmosphere, so everything she says he contradicts, sort of thing. So like when she says, oh no, you can't go swimming tonight, sweetie, it's too late, sort of thing, and he's like, oh no, I'll take you swimming, you know.
It's that
sort of thing, and then you know, then we see them at the lift, and he's sort of going, don't you ever contradict me in front of my daughter, you know, or something along those sort of lines. And then we get the phone call with her mum, sort of going, have you left him yet?
And you're like, oh right, it really
is
that bad.
Yeah, exactly. But then you get the flip side, you know, the other side of that kind of abusive relationship, you know, where, you know, one minute he's sort of really menacing, and then the next minute he's acting like very pathetic and like, I'm lost without, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it is, again, it's just it's a classic abuse sort of profile, isn't it? It's like, you know, trying to control her emotions, you know, sort of trying to guilt trip her, sort of basically saying, this is all your fault, you know, the reason you're getting abused is it's because you're not the perfect wife for me, sort of thing, you know.
And that's the minute she kind of flipped it on him, you know, when she sort of, you know, because he's really ramping it up. And you don't sort of realise that's what he's doing. He's really ramping up the, you know, the kind of intimidation and the unspoken violence. And then when she sort of says, you know, well, what are you going to do? You know, you know, you're going to sort of grab me, and that's when he does that classic thing of, you know, trying to sort of, oh, you know, it's, I can't help it, and you know, and you sort of see her falling. Like her kind of doubting herself, and it's like, oh, you know, no, please. You know,
exactly.
And it's weird because those moments, like I said, because they're so good and they're so stark, you know, I'm watching it, and you know that because of your beloved in media res, you know that something's coming that's going to be killing people in the hallway, and you kind of forget about that inside the room with them, because you're thinking, no, you've got to get out.
Like,
and sort of forgetting that actually, you know, whatever is going to, however that's going to play out, is obviously going to sort of, it's going to run headlong into the problem in the corridor, isn't it?
Absolutely.
In the hall. Which is actually it kind of made me sorry to cut you off, but it was, you know, timely piece of filmmaking, because I mean, it was the thing that actually was grasped really quite quickly, certainly in the UK, and you know, I think sort of probably globally, that, you know, lockdown, that, you know, the reality of our lives for the last kind of year and a half, and no, you can't, everyone has to stay in, and then, you know, after a couple of weeks, it was like, sort of, you know, the charities and police services were saying, that isn't going to work for a lot of people, you know, that's going to be quite potentially sort of, you know, catastrophic. And this was exactly what that film was about, wasn't it, really?
Yeah.
It was like you're trapped in there, but what's outside is you know, genuinely, you know, a really bad situation. So,
yeah, absolutely. So alongside, you know, this couple and their daughter, we also have a Japanese lady called Naomi, who's arrived heavily pregnant, also escaping a dodgy husband. She's arrived, you know, she's left her husband back in Japan, ostensibly for work, so she says, but basically it's to get away. And again, she has a phone call with her mum. You know, it's interesting sort of parallels. You know, I'm sort of just putting this together as we're talking, funnily enough. But, you know, there are interesting parallels between the two, which is kind of interesting.
Very.
Yeah.
Very. And it was, you know, and it was, I think, of quite a different sort of conversation that her mum...
She's in control.
Exactly.
She's more in control. And it's almost as if her mum is the overbearing one. Mm. You know, pulling the heartstrings, you know, sort of playing the guilt card and everything sort of thing. And, you know, you're just running away from your sort of family obligations and things like that. But yeah, that was very interesting. So alongside that, you know, we do find out, which is quite interesting, we do find out about the midway through the film exactly how this situation has arisen. It is it isn't sort of paid enough time, in my opinion. It's a one,
not even slightly.
No, I think it's like 3 minutes of time, you know. And the thing is, it might have been.
It wasn't even halfway. It was way further on than that.
Yeah,
you don't realize the pacing of this film is, you know, it is. I mean, it's a good watch. I don't want to give anyone the impression that it's, but it is. It's not fast. You know, it is actually really quiet. It does, like you say, the immediate res does feel like it's leading it round in circles sometimes. I enjoyed it, but
that's the thing, isn't it? Because it keeps jumping between the two timelines. So we have the stuff previous, you know, 4 hours before, sort of working back towards the present, but it keeps sort of jumping to the present and what's happening there, except nothing is actually happening.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's the same thing, you know, and that whole thing isn't actually resolved or pushed any further until the very final shot of the film.
The very, very final shot of the film, I don't think we can really discuss without it.
Mm.
Like, I don't know. What are your thoughts? Because there's that final, very last second, and it was like, oh. Ah.
Well, this, you know, I found out just before we start recording that there is a planned part two, or chapter two, as it's called.
Excellent. I'll be watching it.
I hope, you know, it's a bit more expansive than what they managed to do here. This is a very sort of close contained story, you know. I mean, the fact that most of it takes place in this you know, hotel hallway, it does sort of go beyond that towards the end, but it is very contained story. It's not a zombie film. You know, the trailer, you know, you might be a bit misled by the trailer. I think it sort of does sort of point in that direction that it might sort of be a zombie film, but it's not.
Yeah, I mean, you can see why, because there are like a few little flags and things and trail markers in there that, you know, that you sort of think,
maybe some part two will show you that it is a zombie film, you know.
Yeah, potentially, but there's also there was to be fair, there's actually a lot. It's a microscopic cast and a tiny set, but. There's a few scenes in this that I think it's really hard, because you think these are really worthy for discussion, but then you think, I don't really want to
give away
too much. Yeah, but exactly, because those little sort of tidbits kind of make the film, really, because they you know, there's a couple of things that happen, there's a couple of scenes that happen. One with the child Kelly much further on in the film,
yeah,
and one with Val, the mum, about sort of two-thirds of the way in, simultaneously actually to the scene that involves Kelly, where your mind just thinks, hang on, wait a minute, what if is this what's happening?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you kind of, it's almost like I was thinking, oh shit, it's a completely different kind of film to what I thought it was. You know,
yeah.
Like is that? But again, it's this is painful. We don't get these very often where you really want to talk about stuff, but you'll just.
It doesn't seem to be any rules. You know, the rules are inconsistent as to how the, you know, the people who are infected react.
Yeah.
And how long it takes them to turn and all the rest of it, you know, if that's what's happening. You know, I mean, for me, that, you know, one of the best scenes is with, you know, the guy, the evil doctor, played by Julian Richings, who I saw that recently.
That man does look very evil.
He does.
I'm sure he's lovely in real life, but
he's been in quite a lot of stuff. You know, he has got one of those sort of very recognisable faces. I saw him recently in a film called Spare Parts, where he played this sort of like self-appointed emperor who was forcing these women to take part in gladiator matches. It's really good. It hasn't come out here yet. I had to buy the German release, and I was really annoyed because this particular German release had cut out all the gory bits. And I'm thinking, Germany, you know, really goes for this sort of stuff. So, you know, come on, Germany, you used to be cool, you know.
You must have got the PG version.
I got the, you know, or the 15 version or something, but you could tell.
Yeah,
I mean, you could tell it was meant to be a lot more gory than it, you know, what they actually showed.
Funnily enough, on the subject of gore, that's something I was just going to say, is that guy, what's his name again?
Julian Richings.
Right. Mm. Does he not remind you of the tall man from the Fantastic?
Yes. Movie? Yeah, he does a bit. Yeah. Was it Angus Grimm?
I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
But, I mean, legendary B movie horror from the from the 80s.
Yeah.
It looks. It does. It did make me think of him.
Mm. And others. Yeah. It's interesting that you know, we do have this sort of Japanese actress called Yumiko Shaku, who plays Naomi in this. Mm. You know, all her part is in Japanese, apart from the conversation she has with Val. And you know, she's a well known TV actress. She's been in some of the sort of Godzilla movies out in Japan. And it, you know, it is interesting casting why they felt the need to have a Japanese person in their film, because you know, because it is an American film or Canadian.
I think if they're not, I think having a very like a small amount of very long ago experience, having gone to the west coast of Canada, is that there is actually quite a large Southeast Asian population over on that side of Canada, and I think that, you know, in terms of markets, maybe they're just simply thinking, first of all, they've got, you know, enough, maybe they've got enough Japanese expats there that they'd be like quite happy to see, you know, that lady on a Canadian release, and perhaps they're also thinking sell it in Japan as well.
Anyway, I think we're going to wrap up, Will. So, how are you going to score Hall?
Oh, I've got to score it high. You know, yeah, everything that you alluded to in your first bit about it chases its own tail for a bit with the immediate res, and that is unfortunate. And it is like, you know, you kind of think they've padded out a story that's less than half the length of the film with, you know, lots of that stuff. Really, you can't ignore that. You can't really let them off the hook with it. But what they stylistically, it is really well shot. It's lovely to look at. It's really good, and the sound design is wonderfully creepy and quite original. You know, just the soundtrack, you know, that kind of the breathing, and you'll understand. People understand when they watch it, and it is, like I say, it's brilliantly shot. It's very slick, very professional, really good set, really good acting, especially that horrible claustrophobic domestic violence scenario that's being played out. All of the cast members are exceptionally talented. Even that, you know, the child who plays Chloe, I don't know her name, but she's really good, and she's tiny. So, you know, so there's just nothing to dislike about what happens when stuff is happening. It's got to be. I would want to give it I'd want to give it an 8, in all honesty. But I'd be feeling a little bit like that they kind of need chiding for spinning it out quite as much as they did. Mm-hmm. As they did. But you don't. I don't know. I don't really want to penalise them. I mean, if I would give them, I'd give them an 8.
Yeah. Okay. I'm giving I'm going to stick to my guns. I'm giving this a 6. It is. Giving it a 6. You think that's harsh? But for me, a 7 is a film which is entertaining, and I'd watch it again. I don't think I could sort of bring myself to watch this again, having seen it. It does have its. It does have its good bits. You know, we've talked about the characterizations and things like that, and getting the, you know, the feel of that sort of domestic situation, sort of spot on. The makeup effects as well are very good. You know, and the people who are infected really sort of pull off this. You know, the suffering through this disease. You know.
I think actually your marking criteria for this, I'm not going to change my view, but it's kind of made me think I don't actually have as strict a criteria for marking. I've probably not been in the loop as much recently as is obvious. I haven't, this is the first show I've done in what, 3 or 4 months?
Oh, wow, yeah.
a long time. And before that it was ages. So I think the more I do, the more brutal I get. Be honest with you,
possibly, yeah.
Right, but
it's like people on IMDb write things like, "Oh, this is the worst film I've ever seen," and it's like, well, clearly you haven't watched enough films. You don't know what bad actually is, mate.
Yeah, I'd say that that's fair. But yeah. Like, all right, I tell you what, my 8 is. My 8 is like some. If it was just complete amateur night. Self-indulgent film school twaddle, you know, where people are just, you know, like, and they just basically dragged out a not very good idea and padded it out with loads of stuff, I would be more brutal. But like what I've watched in this film is a very, very good idea, really, really, a really crystallized and well-executed idea with a couple of hints in it of things that make you, that just make you think, hang on, like, you know, what, wait a second, that are really interested. They have you thinking about something.
Within
the narrative, you know, there's some really, really good ideas going on in there, backed up by some brilliant, like some really good writing, backed up by some brilliant acting kept me interested in those bits. And it kind of makes me forgiving of the fact that they really did just dance around for quite a long time.
The thing is, it's not a particularly long film either. It clocks in at just under 80. Yeah, exactly. Just under 80 minutes. You know, but honestly, I think this would have worked better as a long short film. You know, sort of maybe 40 to 50 minutes. But then, you know, you're not going to get distribution. You know, you end up relegating to YouTube or Vimeo, unfortunately. Yeah. You know, I can sympathise. But so a 6 and an 8 for Hall. There is a promise of a chapter 2 at some point. I hope they do get the funding for it and get that off the ground. Our next review then is Sacrilege. When Kayla discovers the man who assaulted her is now out of prison, she convinces her best friends to go on a spontaneous weekend in the countryside. However, when they are invited to watch a local pagan festival, they unwittingly become sacrifices for the goddess Mabon, who exploits people's fears and turns them against them. Will, so this is a very low budget film. Not the lowest budget sort of film that has sort of passed our way. And I think for the most part, the production does a good job of sort of using its budget wisely, but there are, you know, moments where, you know, you can see through the wallpaper, as it were. You know, as they try to sort of paper over a few gaps, and you know, there's definitely holes. But I found this quite interesting. I'm quite interested in folk horror as it is, and sort of the concept of two concepts running side by side. One is, you know, the sort of idea of like ancient sort of myths coming through through modern times, and you know, and utilizing the countryside and things like that, and also the idea of you know, ordinary people doing evil things for good reasons. Yeah, so we've got this village which is under the thrall of the local priest, a certain Father Saxon. And for whatever reason, this village holds these sort of equinox festivals where they invite the goddess Mabon. Now, the term Mabon, by the way, is actually the term for the autumnal equinox, apparently. So what they've sort of done for the film is sort of, you know, made a sort of personified sort of manifestation of this, you know, this equinox, as it were, coming up with this sort of goddess. And the idea is that, you know, if you offer up sacrifices and then tell her what your fears are, then she will sort of take those fears away and they won't be realized. So we see, for example, a farmer sort of writing down, you know, my milk curdling, you know, in as a genuine fear, you know, and I think it's something about crops, it sort of comes up as well. What we don't know from the film is whether or not this tradition has been part of that village since time began, kind of thing, or is it something conjured up by this Father Saxon character? So this, you know, is it all psychological, or is it actually sort of based in some form of sort of reality?
I don't know. I mean, I think, well, you'd have to sort of judge whether the way that the people doing it, like how invested do they look? And like, you know, do they look as though it's something that they're just, because like, I'd have to say, if it was new cult leader, then there'd be that kind of a lot more obvious willing suspension of disbelief. But, you know, if the people look convincingly like this is what they've watched their parents do, then they'd be a lot more comfortable and relaxed with it.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean. But like, if it's not explicitly spelled out in the film, then it's probably because it's not being felt to kind of matter that much. I mean, if you go back to the grandparent of all this kind of, you know, shtick, it's the Wicker Man, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the original, and the original is still the best. I mean, the Nicolas Cage one, I think, sort of less said the better. But,
like, but even with that Wicker Man, there is still doubt as to whether the fact that they do this ceremony actually makes any difference. You know, is Lord Summerisle just pulling the wool? You know, is he going through this process, you know, this ritual, and keeping his fingers crossed behind his back, sort of thing, going, "I hope this works."
I
hope next year's crop works, you know, it sort of thing. Or do they genuinely believe that, you know, by sacrificing this to the earth, to Gaia or whatever, it is actually going to make a difference? So there's that. In this particular film, when they're doing the ritual, and sort of Father Saxon is talking, there's a bit where his voice kind of cracks when he sort of says, you know, hopefully we can appease you until the next equinox. You know, it's almost
as if he's shitting himself there.
I think it's him sort of, you know, him, you know, the weariness of having to do this, you know, is starting to play on his conscience and his soul. You know, he's like, oh, you know, here you are, here's, you know, but you're never satisfied. We're going to have to do this again in another 6 months, kind of thing, you know. That's the way it comes across. The trouble is, at the end of the film, when Kayla's sort of confronted by sort of the villagers and they're wearing the masks, when they take their masks off, they're all got this sort of like shit-eating grin on their faces. You know, it's like, ha ha, you know, especially the hitchhiker guy, you know, and it's sort of, it goes against that scene. You know, it's like, you're enjoying this. You're enjoying putting this person in this sort of peril.
Yeah. You know, not because you think it's going to make the crops grow, but because you're a statistic, you know.
Exactly. That's what's covered across anyway.
Hatey asshole, basically. That's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah. So the special effects in this film, I mean, there are some sort of CGI effects and things going on.
Yes. I saw the bugs in the sink. I was actually quite surprised and impressed with that.
It was pretty good. I think there was a scene early on when that particular character, which is Trish, who's the sort of the ex-girlfriend of Kayla, she goes out for a jog and she starts sort of freaking out. And I think they forgot to put the CGI bugs in that scene. but at the same time, it works. Because her acting is actually sort of quite good in that scene. She sort of sells the fact, you know, that she's sort of
she's seeing them because the point is not. I mean, you know, maybe it was deliberate because the point is we don't always need to see what they see in order for the film to make sense. It's like she's seeing stuff because she's like tripping out of her gourd or has been hexed. You know, has had a spell cast on her, whichever one you want to believe. And also, I mean, there's question marks over how, like, why are they seeing, or was it magic, or did someone spike them?
Well, you mean they spike that sort of weird joint that was sort of grown locally, and you know the power of suggestion, isn't it? You know, the fact that they're sort of told to sort of write down their fears, so that is going to bring it to the fore of their mind. You know, it's going to be bubbling away in their subconscious. And sort of mixed with a bit of psychotropic drugs, you know, that could sort of manifest itself in that way. So you could look at it that way, or you could say, oh, you know, it's this goddess Maybon who's, you know, sort of making them sort of see their most feared situation, as it were.
This is almost, I mean, it's just making me think of all kinds of kind of magic manipulation type films. This is, what's his name? Dale Van Horn, Jack Nicholson in Witches of Eastwick, asking the three women what their fears were, and then sort of texting, you know, somehow, you know, in a similar way, you know, so it never really explained, like, you know, what is he and how did he make all of that work? You know, what was any of it real? You know, did they really fly? Could they really do magic? Sort of thing. And it's, you know, I like the fact there's ambiguity about whether they just forced the belief into their own minds just by what happened, or they were spiked. And I like the fact that you don't have to see all the CGI. I mean, they could well have just run out of, you know, CGI budget, but I doubt that. I think, you know, it wasn't a sloppy film. It wasn't a film where you're thinking things like that were being left out. I mean, there were things with it that jarred with me personally, which, and I know I'm not alone, because, you know, there's a lot of not very kind things being said about the film.
The trouble is, I think anyone who reads IMDb, for example, a lot of the comments you read on IMDb are by people who, you know, clearly haven't seen enough films. Especially bad ones, you know. When you got someone going like, "Oh, 1 out of 10, the worst film I've ever seen." Go, well, you haven't seen enough films in.
This is
low budget and it has its limitations. But so you need to take that into account to a certain degree.
No, it wasn't just IMDb, although they were really, they seemed particularly vehement about it. There were others, and it's like, it kind of thought, you know, yeah, that, I've got to be honest, like, you know, yeah, I mean, there were things about the film which I was a bit like, wasn't impressed, but it wasn't, not the production of it, the shooting of it, the editing of it, you know, the technical production of it was, you know, bang on, really. It was good for considering that, well, like you say, it's not the highest budget film ever made. It was well made in that sense. You know, the things that were sort of holding it back a bit, some bits of it quite hard to define, actually, in terms of the characterization and the script.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is the sort of the opening 15 minutes of the film. The main actress, Tamarin Payne, is from Hollyoaks. She the sort of long run on Hollyoaks. And that kind of, that's what it felt like. It almost like, I felt like a Channel 4 soap opera production. So I kind of see the point of it. You know, they want to sort of juxtapose this sort of, you know, the urban sort of side of life and the countryside. But it just feels a bit empty. And when they go to that bar to meet their other friend, Blake, who works there, it just felt weird. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen any sort of behind the scenes footage of like when films are record, you know, when they're filming a nightclub scene or something like that, you know, and they don't have the music playing. Everyone's sort of having this sort of dance, and it just sounds, it's really, really bizarre. And it kind of felt like halfway between that and an actual scene. You know, they had the sound levels so that obviously we can hear what was being talked about, but it just felt really bizarre.
Stilted, wasn't it? It was really stilted and strange. But then again, that whole scene was stilted and strange. I mean, it was just so weird. It just shoehorned. It was just trying to shoehorn the two really kind of harsh things onto that girl's sort of play.
So, first of all, there's, oh, here's your ex-girlfriend.
Who you
kind of hate. And here's the guy who beat you up one time and went to prison for it and has been let out and you didn't know about it.
Yeah, and because your ex-girlfriend who cheated on you, who you were really conflicted about, has just come in and said, I want to see if you're okay. Why? Well, because that dude's out. What?
Yeah, and him over there.
And then mate Blake goes, oh, a drink on me. What? Hang on. Why are you not throwing him out? Like, he's just like,
there was a weird red herring as well, because of that scene, you know, where she sort of, you know, she gives him a drink or whatever. When they go into the country and they you know, they got their sort of Airbnb place, Blake stays outside and goes, oh, I'm just going to make a phone call. And I was like, ooh, is she calling that guy? Yeah, is she going to call that guy? Mm-hmm. You know, some weird shit going to go on. But it never sort of comes out that way. You know, I mean, there's other reasons for him to be there and stuff later on. But it was just a bit weird. I mean, I thought it was quite good they went there. I mean, we were talking in the previous review of Hall about the sort of spousal abuse kind of theme that was sort of running through that one, and so we got that sort of, you know, a similar idea here, but it is more rushed, you know, it's not the focus of the film.
And it's not handled well. And it's not handled well.
Not particularly, no. But, you know, kudos for having it there, I think.
I think you tried to... It's as it should be. I mean, it should be approached. It should be dealt with by all society. And, you know, we shouldn't look away from it. Because it's like the horrifying reality of, like, so many people. You know, having it in... As a thing in films is realistic, and, you know, like, and it's the right thing to do. Handling it well, depending on what your subject matter is kind of a critical responsibility. And if you can't, don't bother, because, you know, it's like you're either making an escapist fantasy with that as a kind of key integral part, which needs to be treated with respect, otherwise it's not part of a useful dialogue. You know, or you're kind of, you absolutely can't exploit it to add to the discomfort in a horror or supernatural film. That's just cheap and it's irresponsible. You know, it really, and we saw it in the previous review. I happen to think that was brilliantly done, because it was integral to the narrative, and it was sensitive to all parties involved in kind of real situations like that. And I was just really impressed. Whereas I think this one,
because in the previous one we were seeing an ongoing situation. This is something which has happened, been dealt with, and you know, sort of old sort of scars are sort of being sort of ripped open, as it were. I don't know. I mean, I like the idea that that is her fear. You know, that is what is manifesting for her, and how she deals with it. But maybe it needed a bit more time to sort of develop, you know, within the script.
Mature it.
Yeah.
To mature it. Otherwise, it's not.
Because it's forgotten. I mean, the thing is, I mean, once, and this may be the character's mindset, you know, because after that initial sort of shock at the bar, and they go, "Oh, let's go on holiday for a weekend and get away," it never comes up again. You know, she has a couple of nightmares, but she never talks about it. Nobody asks her about it. You know, maybe it is because they're all a bunch of airheads. Maybe they're all sort of so self-centered that they don't even consider asking her if she's okay about it or whatever.
About having the person who put her in a coma sitting at the other end of the bar being given free drinks by her friend.
By a mate. Yeah, it's a bit of a bizarre situation.
It's to me, that was like, I was sat there going, what's going on? What is happening? How are they just turning around and just having a chat and say, let's go for a weekend of, you know, drinking and hanging out in the country? It's like, what? No. Why? Call the guy's probation officer or something. I don't know.
The other thing as well is that they don't seem to actually take any booze with them. They don't take any supplies whatsoever.
The van is practically empty.
Yeah.
I did like, actually, one thing I thought was quite funny, actually, in the sense that it was really quite depressingly real, was the fact that as soon as they pulled up in their kind of yellow mystery machine van, which they all immediately jumped out and started pointing their phones at the sky, trying to find the signal. And that was like, actually, that's quite funny. That was quite sort of, you know, strong perceptive, because one of the characters pretty much just doesn't exist if she's not staring at her phone taking selfies.
Yeah, sort of a vainglorious one. Yeah,
you know. Yeah, and it was like, that's actually quite funny, quite true. You see it.
They didn't really sort of develop that too much either. So you didn't really sort of see her, you didn't see her Instagram page or anything like that. So, you know, there wasn't any sort of that side of things. It was like, this is what she does. She likes. Yeah, she has her fans, whatever, and that's what she...
That would have been, I mean, because, like, that's actually quite... That's really odd. I wonder if that was a considered decision, but essentially, that's the reality of filmmaking now, isn't it? That that kind of person would be all, like, that would be... She'd be all over that. She'd probably have, like, thousands of followers. She'd be like one of them Love Island type people, wouldn't she?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. That's it, exactly, yeah. So one of the things that does sort of improve the overall quality of the film is the soundtrack. So it's got a score by a guy called Colin McGuinness, and he does a good job of providing a lot of atmosphere. And not so much early on. I mean, it was very sort of electronica kind of stuff, but eventually it was sort of more, you know, sort of deep foreboding sort of like chords and things, over shots of aerial shots of the forest and things like that. So it did help.
There's a lot of drone.
Yeah, there's quite a few good drone shots, which I'll forgive, you know, for this. So sometimes it's not so much drone shots that I mind. It's there's a certain period in the 2000s when everyone thought having a drone in your film was going to be cool. It's like, Mike, what's your character? I'm a drone pilot. If you're doing a heist, if you're doing a heist movie or something like that, it's like one guy is going to be piloting a drone, you know, and it's like, oh God, get me out of here.
Yeah.
using it for overhead shots and things, that's fine. You know, that's part and parcel of low budget filmmaking these days, I think. It does help elevate the film, you know, give you more establishing shots and things.
Was that a deliberate pun, by word?
Maybe. I'm going to say yes. As if I even know which. What did I say accidentally?
Elevate. We're talking about drone shots, like you know, aerial drone shots, and you said elevate the movie. You know.
Oh. Yes, that was totally obvious. Totally. Okay, I think we're going to wrap
and
up.
Also,
yeah, go on.
One last thing. There was one bit of in media res, but I thought it was quite, you know, they were quite trained with it.
No. It wasn't in media res. I'm quite happy with that sort of prologue thing where you know, so we get a little prologue at the beginning showing what had happened the previous year to the sort of final victim, the final sacrifice. And it was actually a good sort of physical, you know, sort of guy on fire stunt. You know, it wasn't CGI, it was an actual sort of guy on fire stunt. Yeah. So that's fine. That's the way things should be done. It's, you know, it's like, because it establishes the threat, you know. So so you're thinking, oh, there's something going on here, but we don't know what it is. And these people are walking into it. What I hate is a film which jumps you right in the middle of things, stops the film and goes, well, I bet you're wondering how we got here. If you're feeling a sense of deja vu, it is because this section is identical to the tirade I made in the Hall review about In Media Res. So apologies, I've edited this bit out. Anyway... it's like every week I have to go through In Media Res.
Sorry, mate. I can't help it. I can't help bringing it up. I won't do it again.
Poke the bear.
Yeah. Pretty much, yeah. I'm sorry.
Okay. How are you going to score Sacrilege?
It wasn't the strongest film I've seen. It really, you know, it kind of jarred me. I mean, like, just in terms of the characters really weren't that relatable, and that whole thing at the beginning, I was just like, I'm not buying into this, you know, like that. It seemed a bit of a shame, really, because it was well made, and they put a lot of effort into it, and they're not, you know, it wasn't a bad idea. It's just like the script just seemed a bit sort of just weird. It was just like hard to believe, but it wasn't trying to be massively original. It's still a cabin in the woods. You know,
yeah, exactly. Horror, yeah,
really. And the bits of it that were done well were done really more than competently. But unfortunately, yeah, it was just let down a bit by the script.
Put a number on it, Will.
Oh man, I know this is like the X Factor when they say we need your decision. Okay, I feel generous giving it a 7, but that's what I'll do.
A 7. Yeah. Funny enough, that's
I want to give it a 6, but I feel like a bit of a tool.
I agree with you. I think there's enough here. When I did my written review, I also gave it a 7. So I think it does have problems early on. You know, the whole suburban bit, the thing in the bar, it doesn't really work. It needed more sort of developing. But once they all move into the countryside and you know, pick up the hitchhiker, which is a nice sort of nod to Texas Chainsaw Massacre as well. You know, once all that happens, you know, the atmosphere changes, spooky stuff starts going on. I think it does really well. And I think the production design of the effigy for Mayborn itself, I thought was brilliant. The thorny sort of figure that they had at the ritual, that was really, really well done.
Kind of contemporary Wicker Man.
So yeah, 2 7s for Sacrilege. Go check it out. Our short shot this week is The Manor. In this one, we got 4 people who turn up to a manor, doing a location scouting exercise for a new horror film. We have four characters. We've got Lara, Lisa, Andy, and somebody else. Do you know who the bearded one was called?
I don't, you know.
No, I don't think he actually gave...
Leather flight jacket.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. Well, we've got Andy, who's the Chinese one. Lara is the sort of the main actress. Mm. And yeah, they rock up to this building to do some sort of location scouting for a horror film that they're putting together. And weird shenanigans start going on. I was reminded of a couple of things. One is the film Triangle, the Christopher Smith film. I don't know if you've seen that.
Remind me, because
it's about this woman who joins her boyfriend on this sailing trip, and they end up boarding a sort of cruise liner where there's nobody on board apart from a masked killer. And it turns out I'm not going to say anymore. You really, really should. And if anyone else hasn't seen it, they really should check it out as well. Very, very interesting film. But have you heard of a book called The House of Leaves?
Yes, I have. I even read most of it. And I mean, it was quite a while ago and I struggled. But yeah,
I reckon most people would reply in exactly the same way. Yes, I've read most of it.
I've read most of it, yeah. It's brilliant. I mean, and there's some brilliant writing in it, and there's some really brilliant spooky, because it's a really spooky idea. I mean, like the whole, you know, the whole sort of concept of what's happening to this guy, you know, is really good. And there's some brilliant writing, but it's like, it's also confusing as hell, and you know,
you need to read what's in the footnotes at the same time as what you're actually reading in the main thing, and then all weird shit's going on. Anyway, so this has a little bit of a flavour of that, So I was quite impressed with this, the way the story develops, because it starts off with the character Lara sort of looking up at the house. And just sort of says, I'm thinking about adding an extra scene. It's a bit of a cliche, but you know, when somebody looks up at the house and sees somebody in the window, looking back at them, and then we see what happens in the film, and it's brilliant. I was genuinely surprised by that. You know, I was watching it and I was like, oh, that's a really cool twist. You know what they did there.
It's clever and it is spooky. It's a brilliant concept. It is exactly right for 15, because you watch it thinking it was 15 minutes, and I'm thinking, no, there's because it's building up very, very cleverly. It feels like a build up in a feature, and you're thinking there's no way that there's only, and it's odd because I had this really weird thing. I was watching the counter at the bottom because I had to keep an eye. I was keeping an eye on the time while I was watching it. Don't judge me. I was enjoying the film. I wasn't just kind of clock watching. And at the start, I was like, "How are they going to spin this out for 15 minutes?" But you know, within 5 minutes, you're like, "Okay, it's building quite quickly." And then you know, it's getting to sort of the last 3 minutes, and you're like, "They can't wrap this up in 3 minutes." You know, there's way too much. And it's like, it's a brilliantly well staged and well paced concept. It's very good.
Yeah, I mean it takes, you know, a couple of minutes for you to understand what's going on. You know, it's the usual setup, you know, sort of four people rock up at this house, split up and go their separate ways. You know,
for no reason.
Not exactly any particular reason.
Yeah, why would you do that?
But well, there is one funny bit as well where the guy with sort of the bearded guy. Sorry, I don't know his name. And IMDb is no help on this whatsoever. There's a bit where he's sort of following some spooky noises or something. He just gets to the door and he goes, "Nah, not going in there, mate." Yeah, which I thought was brilliant. Finally. You know, Somebody who is sort of self-aware enough to sort of go, "Shit, I'm in a horror film." Which I thought was brilliant. So this is just really, really smart. You know, it's an interesting sort of conundrum they've sort of delivered. You know, sort of the reasons why or how don't come into it at all. It's, you know, it's 14 minutes short, but it's handled really, really well. And it did leave me wanting more. So, you know, you can't end it there. You can't just sort of cut it off there, for God's sake. I mean, that's what you want, isn't it? Yeah, exactly.
Leave them wanting more. I think it was a showcase for basically all the skills that you would want at your disposal to execute a very creepy supernatural horror or thriller.
Yeah,
like all absolutely. Showcased in a condensed 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And you know, in contrast to the first film that we reviewed, the previous film we reviewed,
mm-hmm.
the Sacrilege. Sacrilege one. The actors, they had a much more concise script to work with. They mm-hmm. they seemed a lot more comfortable with it because it was so concise, and also, you know, it was tighter, I think, in terms of how it was directed. But, you know, I think probably it's a 50-minute thing, so all of the scenes and cuts were a lot more kind of condensed, I think. And yep. it was very pleasurable to watch, because it was like a technical exercise, but you know, stitching together lots of really, really brilliant techniques that you'd want to see in a great film. But actually they weren't just they were actually holding up a really interesting narrative. Even though it was only 50 minutes long, you're like wondering, what the hell? Okay. Oh, now I know what's going on. Oh, no, I don't.
so this is written and directed by a guy called Blake Ridder. We haven't actually covered any of his shorts before. He's done quite a few, and I'm interested in a few of them, especially one he's done called Help, because that is now being developed into a feature. And so I'd be interested to sort of see the short and then the, you know, the finished film as well. Yeah. So it seems like he works with some of the same actors again. You know, Lewis James, who was in the bearded guy, basically, in this one, is also in that one. He also sort of, Blake also sort of stars in some of his own films as well. So very, very impressive. I mean, I'll be talking to Rich about this one shortly, and, you know, hopefully getting sort of more of Blake's films to look at, because he's done quite a few this year. So interesting. So that is The Manor. We really like this. I hope you do too. You will find a link to it in the footnotes, so please go and check it out. So to finish off this week's episode, we have an interview with the director of Sacrilege, David Creed. Take it away, Mike. Okay, so I am sat down with David Creed, the writer and director of the new British folk horror movie Sacrilege, in which four young women spontaneously go to the countryside for a weekend and unwittingly find themselves the sacrifices for a pagan ritual. David, welcome.
Hiya, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so this is, as I said, it's a folk horror film. It's sort of, you know, the core of it is about sort of pagan beliefs. And so one of the things I do sort of quite enjoy is films about people doing horrible things for sort of good reasons, as it were. So, you know, things like The Wicker Man, where, you know, they're doing what they do to sort of keep the crops up, you know, going and things like that. Whether or not it's actually true is another matter, but that's their belief. And I think that's the core of what is actually happening here. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not out of a sense of malice exactly. It's more for the community. But, you know, so they seem very detached from what's going on.
Right. Yeah. For me, the kind of spine of the film is ultimately kind of mental health and mental awareness. But it plays into both sides. So you have the obviously the core for women that are, you know, have fears, as we all do. But then you've also got the actual kind of pagan cult that they also believe to a ridiculous degree that what they're doing is right. So, you know, so their mental health is also all over the place, because actually it doesn't work. It's not, you know, it's just something, this thing, you know, this entity, this Father Saxon guy who kind of, who's convinced all of these people that this is the way that they can kind of keep going and eventually break their own, you know, kind of spell and yeah, stay alive. So you actually, it's the clash of that. And yeah, like you say, I think certainly something that we do well in the UK is the whole folk horror. And I think kind of messing with people's heads when it comes to those kind of beliefs, really, and yeah, how to hopefully escape it.
Yeah, because the script, it's sort of it's a very fine line, I think, isn't it? That it sort of walks between, as you say, you know, is this purely in their heads, or is there a supernatural element? And it's that sort of fine throughway between the two that you've managed to sort of, you know, balance all the way through, I think. So the central location for the film is this really nice sort of country estate thing. Whereabouts did you actually film?
Yeah, so we filmed that in a place just up the road from where Mark and I, Mark's the producer, where we both live. So I live in Bristol, Mark lives in Swindon. And there's a fantastic area called Forest of Dean.
Yeah, I know it well. I know Bristol well. I lived there for 15 years myself.
Right, cool. Yeah, so that was kind of our plan, really, was, right, how can we make a movie, you know, that looks great on, you know, relatively small amount of money, that's local to us, right, to kind of keep costs down and things like that. And, yeah, Forest of Dean's on the doorstep, so we kind of went and had a look at, you know, quite a few places. And this one kind of had everything that we needed, and I felt that we needed to tell the story.
Mm-hmm. And so what time of year were you filming?
We shot in May.
Oh, not too bad then, because I was just thinking of the swimming scenes in the film, because you got that outside pool, and I was thinking, I hope it was a reasonable time of year, because that's probably not a heated pool.
Yeah, and thank Joe. Yeah, so thankfully the pool was heated.
Oh, was.
Yeah, but they did say to us, because we said, oh, that'd be great if we can kind of, you know, heat it. Because the other thing as well is, obviously, by having the heated pool, then what was after was the kind of steam coming off the top of the water. Mm. And the groundsman said, oh, yeah, it's heated. It heats up really nicely. You're like, okay, cool. He said, but, you know, it takes like, you know, 2 or 3 days to get to that temperature. And you're like, oh. Right, okay. So we literally had to
switch it on as soon as it got there.
Right, but we kind of had to work it around the schedule, because like as soon as you turn the heating on, all of a sudden you've got the sound guy going, I can hear a constant humming, you know what I mean? You're like, oh man. So we had to turn it off, and then, you know, then we finished and moved away from the pool area, then we could, because there was like a pool, like, you know, kind of machinery hut kind of thing. And that was near, obviously, where we were filming about like 3 or 4 different scenes. So we kind of had to turn it off and then film and then go back, and someone had to turn it back on again. And then, you know, we just had to keep doing that and then hope that it got up to temperature from when we shot, because it was at night and, you know, quite chilly and what have you as well. So, but Sean was really game, and yeah, it was great. And thankfully it was, at least,
It's one of those things, isn't it? It's, you know, you pull one thread to solve one problem, something else unravels elsewhere at the same time. So the main thing we have is the goddess Maybok is the one that's sort of the center of this. And so you got this really interesting sort of effigy that's sort of, you know, part of the thing. Who designed that for you?
So I had an initial design myself of kind of what I wanted to look like, and the kind of bits and pieces that we, you know, how it became what it was. Mm-hmm. Then worked with a couple of different designers, who have worked on massive movies, Shape of Water and some Marvel films and stuff like that. Greg Semko was one of the designers, and Konstantin Sekeris, who designed the vampires in Blade 2. And so I just said, look, this is kind of what I'm thinking, what do you think? And then he came back and was like, look, did a really amazing pencil drawing and said, do you like this? What do you think? And I'm like, yeah, that's it. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. So I then took that to the actual props department and the art department and just said, look, what can we do? And there was the whole idea was that it was like a double skulled kind of, you know, deer and antlers and stuff. And then they literally just took that kind of earthy nature kind of elements and wound like real twigs. Mm. Moss and stuff like that into it, and it looked amazing. It was quite a bulky thing to carry around.
But that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, it is the sort of epitome of that sort of when you think of sort of pagan rituals and sort of folklore, that's exactly what you want to see, is that sort of thing which sort of almost sort of born of the earth. You know, it has a sort of almost sort of drawn from nature kind of feel to it. So it is very impressive. So the fears, Maybon, she draws on people's fears. She's just, like, able to exploit them. If you follow the thinking in the film, the fears that the four ladies have are sort of quite down to earth. You know, they are sort of realistic sort of fears. I'm just wondering if in like an earlier draft of the screenplay, you had had something more fantastical in mind.
I didn't. One of the fears did change, but again, that was quite born out of reality. I think because of what I wanted to do was have it relatable, really, like have it so that, you know, so when you're watching it, that you feel for the women, you feel that actually this is a fear that you could have, you know, and then, but it also then becomes like cinematically what works, you know, like I don't like heights, but to try and get that across cinematically was really difficult because, you know what I mean? You kind of go, well, you know, because for someone that doesn't like heights, you just don't go anywhere high, right? You know what I mean? And so it was, and then trying to force that into a story that didn't gel with the other fears. But one of the fears, so when with the character Blake, she has a fear of dogs. Originally that was rats, because I don't particularly like rats either. And I thought that would look quite good. But it soon became quite obvious that whilst we could get a rat trainer that had rats, because there was a guy that did rats on the Mummy movie with Tom Cruise.
Yeah,
so there's scenes in that were real rats, but some of them were CG and stuff. And but again, it was very much like, well, look, these things, they still kind of have their own, you know, their own mind. So to a point, they'll do what you ask them to do. But outside of that, they can just run off and, and where we were, because it was quite open. What we didn't want was a rat running off and then suddenly causing a rat problem. You know, at the property.
I'm sure there's lots of cables around and everything.
Right, exactly. So we're like, oh, okay. And then, like, we spoke to our, you know, visual effects guys at Primary VFX in Bristol, and they were like, yeah, look, we can do it, and it will look amazing, but that's a lot of work. You're talking about, you know, hundreds of rats that are all individually animated, and, you know, it's just like, oh, man, okay, how do we do that? Because we'd already got the bugs scene, and you know, so it's like, okay, so we went into fears and I just started looking at different fears. And then Mark, the producer, was saying, oh, well, you know, like, as long as you don't do dogs, because I don't like dogs. And I said, we've shut up.
Bing.
So I was like, dogs, it is there. And he was like, oh my God. So it's great. And then we ended up finding a guy who actually supplied dogs to Game of Thrones and things like that. This beautiful Rottweiler called Oscar. Who was amazing but absolutely terrifying, but he was great. So it was very much kind of like, you know, let's keep the fears grounded so at least people got some kind of, you know, that they can relate to them, basically.
Absolutely. And that particular scene with Blake and the dog is really well done. And I must admit, I was sort of wondering how it was going to sort of end when she got into the van. I'm thinking, is he going to come smashing through the window or whatever, you know? But yeah, that was really well played, I thought. That's
thank you. Yeah, it was a really challenging scene to shoot because it's the scene itself, obviously, is shot in a, you know, because we wanted her to try and get away and, you know, and have lots of tension, kind of, you know, where's the dog going to appear and all this kind of stuff, especially because the idea is that these fears are a manifestation of their fears. So they can do things that you wouldn't normally expect the, you know, real dogs to do, as it were.
And, yeah.
You know, and I think it's just that, yeah, having that sense of what that fear is. It's not real, it is in your head, but you think it's so real, so it becomes, you know, right, we've got to shoot over here and then there's another there, and you've got to try and stitch them together in the edit. So I work closely with the editor to make sure that what I was shooting was what he could use in the edit. And then, you know, so in that one whole scene we shot in, I think, like six different locations, just to kind of make it kind of stitch together. So that was quite a challenge. And Oscar's a big old dog, man. That's a big old dog. And he was very intimidating. At one point, the boom op had the boom down by the side of a bush.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is, so the way the trainer gets the dog to kind of do what we need it to do is he has toys. And the fluffy boom cover.
All right, yes.
Right, looked like a toy. So the dog went for it, and the sound up was like, oh gee, boom up fell over, and it was like, oh my god. And you know, but it thought it was a toy, it was just playing.
So
we did have a couple of moments like that where we were just like, no, don't worry about it, mate. Don't worry about that. We'll add some growl. We got some growling already. We'll put that in post. That's fine. Just keep yourself out of the way and what have you. But there was a full team of safety, you know, people there as well as the trainer and stuff. But it was probably one of the most challenging parts of the shoot, just because you're working with a real dog. And
yeah,
and
never work with dogs and children, they say, isn't it?
Yeah, right, exactly. And we kind of, yeah, we threw that out the window and went for it, right? But
it works.
We did the two things that stunt people kind of don't really like doing. We set a guy on fire for real, and had a very large dog working with an actress that hadn't worked with a very large dog before. But Sean was great. I mean, you know, she loved the dog and stuff anyway, but quite challenging. Cool.
Now the kind of like the elephant in the room is the fear that Kayla, Tamara and Payne's character, faces, which is it's going to strike the biggest nerve probably with the audience, especially female audience, because as we find out at the beginning of the film, she had been attacked by some douche of a guy at some point, and he had just got out of prison, and she'd sort of found out a little bit too late, partly because she hadn't opened her mail that morning. But so being faced with that, you know, the guy's scot-free and in the same bar as her must have been, you know, for the character, must be terrifying for a start. But then, you know, to have that sort of being faced with that sort of later on as well in that sort of location. I believe that's going to strike a nerve.
Yeah, I hope so. And it's funny because actually that part of it was something that I personally experienced. And, you know, I had, unfortunately had a partner that needed some help and didn't get it, but took it out on me. And, you know, and you kind of draw on that, and, you know, and things like that, like she would just turn up out of nowhere and stand in front of my window and kind of, you know, that it was, you know, and it was a horrible experience, especially for a bloke, right? It's, you know, this whole, it's really antiquated now, but the whole thing that men are stronger and all this sort of absolute rubbish. But it, you know, when you feel like you should be in a position to be able to cope with a situation like that. And actually, it's incredibly difficult because people are unpredictable.
Yeah.
With animals and stuff, you can usually predict what they're going to do. I've got a dog and I love her to bits, but she'll do whatever I want her to do if I give her some food, right? If I give them some treats, you do what I like. But you can't do that with people because people just don't respond that way. So I think that was why I wanted to include that as a fear, because so Kayla had never been sexually assaulted by this guy. She'd been mentally assaulted by him and physically in a sense of, you know, a fight and, you know, that kind of stuff, which is, you know, where it came from for me. And I think that it's relatable across everybody, really. I mean, you know, like male suicide is so prevalent. It's the biggest killer of men in the country, right? And I think a lot of it is because men don't talk. And, you know, and I thought that this was a good route to raise that kind of mental health issue, and especially for Kayla's character to go through something that wasn't a traditional fear, right? So the other guys got kind of traditional fears. I'm afraid of dogs. I'm afraid of, you know, bugs. I'm afraid of like growing old or, you know, losing looks and all that sort of stuff. They're kind of traditional fears. Whereas this is actually something that's quite, I think certainly at the moment, quite prevalent. And
it is. And at the same time, it's hardly touched upon in film. You know, it is sort of, especially in this way, and especially in horror films, I think, you know, it's not something that really has been sort of grasped as much as it possibly should do.
Yeah, do you know what? One of my favourite movies is The Babadook. I think they do it very well. Jennifer Kent, I think, made an outstanding film, and I think off the back of that, it's certainly, you know, stuff like that helps you. You kind of look and you realise the trauma and you realise the kind of anxiety. And again, what that film's certainly good at is, you know, hopefully very similar here, where you're not quite sure, is it in her head or has she actually, because of her anxiety and, you know, her pain that she's going through, has she manifested this Babadook thing? Is it on her? You know, and it's great, just, you know, the way it unravels. And you're right, and I think that's it. I think the beauty of horror is, you can have a lot of social commentary, a lot of things going on in it, but wrapped up in something that's hopefully very entertaining, and you get something else out of, right? You can still watch it and say, do you know what? I really like those characters. I didn't want that character to die, or, you know, I was looking for this character, or I really like this. And, you know, I've had people come back and go, oh, you know, can you make a movie about that Father Saxon? He's so interesting. Mm-hmm. So cool. He's not in it enough for me, and, you know, and he's like, no, but I did that on purpose, because I think there are a lot of movies where you spend so much time on the bad guy that they lose their mystery and kind of, you know, whatever. Whereas here you kind of get enough of this, you know, pagan douchebag that's you know, that you kind of want to find out more, but you actually want him to be overcome and you know, lose in the end, as it were.
Just want to sort of wrap up talking about the score for this film, because I mean, I imagine this was a relatively sort of modest budget film overall,
by the least. Yeah,
but you say the soundtrack by Colin McGuinness really gives it an extra sort of epic sort of scope. You know, it really has that sort of really sort of foreboding orchestral sort of oomph to it.
It's a big movie feel to it, right? It, you know, yeah, exactly. I mean, I've known Colin for years, and he's worked on my short films and things that we've done before that have done well. And, you know, so for me, it was really, there was no other choice really to, you know, but to speak with Colin and see if he'd be interested in doing this. And, you know, he's such a great guy. And again, what he's really good at is understanding what I was looking for. You know, where the music's got to come from. So I was, you know, I was very aware that what I wanted to do was when we're in the, at the start of the movie, when we're in, you know, suburbia and, you know, we're kind of in the normal, you know, towns and what have you, and houses, the music, I wanted the music to feel very, not fake, but kind of, you know, modern instruments, digital instruments, you know, things like that, that kind of felt right for that kind of area. And then as soon as we kind of started to get into the, you know, out into the country and kind of further away from civilization in that sense, then I asked Colin if we could use just kind of natural instruments in that sense. So, you know, wood instruments and, you know, things like that we could, you know, drums and bits and pieces like that, that essentially could have been made by those guys to use, you know, like the whacking of stick, things like that. And he just, and he said, what scope have I got? I said, go nuts, mate. You know, come give me something that you think is epic as an opener, as a closer. And then, you know, here's the movie, watch the movie and give me what you think works, you know. And he's very good because he doesn't, just because he's allowed that kind of freedom, he doesn't just go, right, there's all of this music. You've got to listen to all of this. You know, you've got to put this all in. Mm. He's still very aware that the way that we cut the movie, when there needs to be no music, do you know what I mean? And it's just the sound design, you know? So he's like, actually, I'm not going to put anything in there. And then, you know, and it would be me that goes back and say, mate, can we just have a little something here? And he's like, yeah, of course I can. And then go away and do that. And, you know, and so it was great because literally when we got the sound, I mean, I think there was a couple of, I gave him a couple of notes at the very start on the first time he gave it to me. But after that, it was brilliant. It just such a good job. I mean, it's so good that, again, I don't know if you know, but we're up in a couple of weeks' time at the Royal Television Society. We've been nominated for best score based on
Colin's
video. So, which is like, why wouldn't we, right? I mean, it's brilliant, isn't it? It's like you say, definitely. Thank you, mate. Yeah, I think it certainly raises the movie a level that we wouldn't have had if we didn't have Colin on board.
One final thing. You mentioned the Babadook earlier. What would you say were your sort of horror touchstones, your sort of influences?
I think the obvious one's probably The Wicker Man. I just think it's a masterpiece. And then movies like The Shining, The Exorcist, even modern movies I really like The Conjuring, I think was just a brilliant piece of cinema. Definitely those kind of movies. I'm not personally a big gore hound. I'm not really lots of blood and guts. You know, I mean, I love the TV show Hannibal when that was on. But yeah, I'm not a, I like more psychological, supernatural kind of, you know, movies like that, really.
It just occurred to me that there might have been a Texas Chainsaw Massacre sort of reference
with
a hitchhiker. Yeah. It just came to me then while we were talking. I thought, oh, yeah.
No, you're right. It's funny. I did. I did list them. I think there was eight references to other movies in the film. Just subtle little nods that are like me going, you know, look, I love this movie. The original Texas Chainsaw is just, incredible. So that was definitely in there. There's a Back to the Future reference in there as well somewhere, I think. But
have another look. Okay, so Dave, we're going to wrap it up there.
Cool, thank you for having me.
No problem. Thoroughly enjoyed that. I went, actually, it was a lot longer than I expected, than I meant it to be, but never mind. So Sacrilege should be out on streaming.
So it's now on Amazon Prime, Apple iTunes, Xbox, Sky Store.
All the usuals.
All the usuals, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, David.
Thank you for listening to the DTV Digest. Let us know your thoughts in the comments and tune in again next time.